Whatever happened to tradition, history, belonging, and the future of the West? Tim Stanley, Bloomsbury Continuum, 2021, 272 pages, a book review from Books at a Glance by Mark Coppinger. This is an alternatively gratifying and exasperating book, which I could scarcely put down. It's all over the place, with a cornucopia of striking quotations, illustrations, defamations, salutations, venerations, obfuscations, illuminations, and misdirections. Gems on successive pages, and then a head-scratcher or howler on the next. Stanley's been on quite a journey, raised as a Baptist with transitions to ordinary Anglicanism, Anglo-Catholic Anglicanism, and Roman Catholicism. He began his political life in the Labour Party, even running unsuccessfully for MP on that ticket, but has come round to voting Conservative. He discarded some impedimenta, but has held on to other baggage. In this connection, he's like an American who's lived in El Paso, Atlanta, Portland, Boston, and Memphis. A man who wears cowboy boots as he sips his Coke through a paper straw when tackling a combo plate of lobster and barbecue. In British terms, he's Conservative, a columnist for The Telegraph, rather than The Guardian, backing Brexit and preferring Romney to Obama, whom he tags with the mendacity of hope. But he's keen on the Green New Deal and Black Lives Matter, condescending toward Americans alarmed over drag queen story hours, warmly disposed toward Christian socialism, and reluctant to say anything kind about capitalism. One of the greatest enemies of truth, beauty, excellence, authority, and self-government is the untrammeled free market. He despises Trump and warms to Margaret Thatcher. He's been featured on CNN, MSNBC, and BBC, but also on Sky News. His basic case is that the Enlightenment birthed economic self-interest and individualism, both of which are killing our appreciation for and subscription to tradition. The liberalism it spawned has created a permanent rebellion against the past. We're being encouraged to examine our ancestors with skepticism, even contempt. They were superstitious, ignorant, and dead by 40. Thus, we are ruining ourselves. In contrast, tradition salubriously connects the individual to their society, passes along social knowledge, and transcends time and space. Make no mistake, tradition doesn't entail stultification or ossification. As Gustav Mahler is quoted to say, it's not the worship of ashes, but the preservation of fire. And it evolves in healthy, healthful ways. He says he can live with the institution of British royalty, while he notes that it grew more palpable when they stopped executing their rivals, for example, Mary, Queen of Scots. For those of us who lament the collapse of Western civilization, society generated by and infused with Judeo-Christian wisdom, Stanley serves up rhetorical red meat. He observes that we are at war with our own history and to blame for our loss of identity. It's not the Muslims' fault that, quite possibly, within a few years there will be more mosques in Britain than in Iraq. In this connection, he quotes a sheikh's son to say, "You don't have children, you abort your babies, you are homosexuals, your churches are empty." Indeed, we've lost our way. The ambition of the 60s, we thought, was that people should be judged on the content of their character, not their external appearance. But now we are ranked by our level of victimhood, and bigotry is not beaten back but evaded with segregation rebranded as a safe space. We are told that prejudice is systemic, which is a code for inevitable, but it is not. But if it is inevitable, on what basis can progress be achieved? Can white people ever not be racist or men not sexist? And the deconstruction starts early. The contemporary school has become as much a place of forgetting as it is a place of learning. We think we're raising children without a pre-packed identity, but we're really not. We are giving them the alternative identity of a person in search of an identity. Educating a child to think and act independently is a good thing, obviously, but if the individual is to be anything other than an aimless wanderer, they need to be instilled with a sense of self that is beyond the self, be it the transcendence of music or the community of a church. This is what we do when we raise a child in tradition. Religiously, he's all in on his Catholicism. He begins and ends the book with the apt image of Notre Dame Cathedral, representing a unity of faith and art, purpose and design, making it the very pinnacle of the Christian tradition. Want to keep it going? The trick is to live it. Of course, you'd wish for more awareness or acknowledgement of the sovereignty of God in preserving and enlivening the church, something more than a life hack we mortals deploy, but he does well to call out the debilitating behavior of particular congregations and denominations. Alas, Stanley's version of living it lacks a Reformation cast. Instead of embracing sola scriptura, he shows his affinity for a Catholic version of authority as a three-legged stool, whose legs are scripture, sacred tradition, and deliverances of the magisterium, with overwhelming evidence, emphasis on two. Indeed, this book offers precious little in the way of Bible discourse, and a lot on tradition, much of it unmoored to anything recognizably sacred. Case in point, versus the shallow funerals we call celebrations of life, he compares favorably the treatment of the dead by the Toraja people of South Sulawesi, Indonesia. Their funerals are of such importance that an entire lifetime's work can go into paying for them. The productions are so elaborate that in the months required to arrange them, the deceased is embalmed, dressed, and placed in the home, where life continues as normally as possible. The corpse attends meals, sitting in its usual chair. At night it is laid out on its bed. One photo shows a family member adjusting a Yankee ball cap on the shriveled body of a relative sporting a cigarette. When Stanley does address the Bible, he shows himself a biblical errantist and is accordingly apt to fumble. For example, it is possible that the Jews picked circumcision up from the Egyptians. And then there's his treatment of Abraham's near sacrifice of Isaac, which he calls one of the most unreasonable bits of the Bible. Some biblical commentaries insist that Abraham knew he wouldn't have to kill Isaac. God had promised him that his sons would inherit the land. Therefore, God would have to break his own contract to go through with it, which his presumably wouldn't do. I find this unconvincing. It turns a traumatic situation into a game of bluff. I prefer to see the story as a comment on parenthood and familial responsibility. We mustn't over-psychoanalyze the story of Abraham and Isaac, because that what really matters is the outcome. Son trusts father, father comes through for son. Maybe Stanley just never got around to reading Hebrews 11, 17 through 19. Alas, his apparent biblical illiteracy doesn't slow his forays into theology. According to Christian teaching, we are all born with an instinct to worship and with the capacity to be a good person. This is the Christian understanding of conscience, not something we invent for ourselves, but a gift from God planted in each of us at our birth. Well, yes, Romans 2, 14 through 15 speaks to the instinctive consciousness of the Gentile, but where's the nuance that at least picks up on the reality of the fall? Perhaps he's never heard of Tulip or counts it nothing to note. And yes, Romans 1, 22 through 23 shows man with a hankering to worship, but it typically goes off the rails into idolatry, not the rosy picture Stanley suggests. As for doctrine, he demonstrates his liberation from believers' immersion, taught by his Baptist upbringers. He calls it a very interesting take on baptism. One, he says, is at variance with the convictions of most Christians, who are happy to perform this ritual shortly after birth. The underlying problem, Baptists have a deeply emotional and instinctual faith, but with their emphasis upon an individual relationship with God and their respect for reason, they are very much children of the Enlightenment. Thus, Stanley cautions, when an 8-year-old declares Jesus is Lord, it can be said that out of the mouths of babes comes great wisdom. Yet it's highly likely they are recycling something the pastor said on Sunday, a pattern of imitation interpreted as intuition that one sees a lot on social media. Well, yes, it happens in cases. It also doesn't in many other cases. Either way, since when is the answer to ritualize salvation upon an addled newborn by a sprinkling of water? And who knew that those good old boys down at Caney Creek or Hog Branch Baptist Church in Dixie were cat's paws of the Enlightenment, slaves to reason? They thought they were New Testament believers. As if it weren't enough to venture into Christian theology, Stanley briefs us on the deep virtues of other faiths, including Islam. For context, I'll mention a Kurdish friend in Nashville, one who maintains that ISIS is not a corruption of Islam, but rather the very soul of the Islam that subjugated his people, formerly the Medes, in the 7th century. But Stanley waxes rhapsodic over 7th century Islam as he castigates ISIS as a tradition-killing perversion of Muslim culture. Slavery was a fact of life in contemporary Arabia.
It wouldn't have been revolutionary to try to eliminate it, but Muhammad and his successors encouraged kindness, praised manumission, and taught that the believing slave is superior to the free pagan, all of which raised the status of the Arabian slave to that of a human being with quasi-legal rights. The trend was towards gradual emancipation. The soul of Islam, along with its sublime quality of mercy, was missing from ISIS. Custom and ritual were enforced to assert dominance and power. One scarcely knows where to begin in addressing this conceit. Yes, Jordanian Islam is nicer than the Talibanite sort. Yes, there's a general distinction between desert Saudi and island Indonesian Islam, which is often syncretistic. But where does Stanley signal awareness that the diminutive, which he associates with ISIS, is a widespread centuries-old Islamic practice, that apostates are brutalized in Pakistan and Iran, that there's a striking difference, 20%+, between male and female literacy in Egypt, that familiar honor killings are common throughout the Middle East, even occurring among Muslims in the West, that academia is so benighted to the Islamic world that only 3 Muslims, compared with nearly 200 Jews, have received Nobel Prizes in the sciences, and each of them did their doctoral studies in either England or America, that the Quran is devoid of anything suggesting that Allah manifests costly agape love. Along the way, Stanley quotes or comments on a host of folks, including George Floyd, Matthew Arnold, Pete Buttigieg, Edmund Burke, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ann Coulter, Friedrich Engels, Isaiah Berlin, Walter Bagehot, Emmanuel Macron, Elizabeth II, Haile Selassie, Winston Churchill, J.S. Bach, Marshall McLuhan, Bill Gates, Alan Bloom, Fyodor Dostoevsky, C.S. Lewis, Steven Pinker, Benjamin Disraeli, Thomas Hobbes, Prince Harry, Jordan Peterson, Jared Diamond, William Morris, Christopher Hitchens, Michael Foucault, and Vladimir Putin. And in his Catholic vein, he gives attention, sometimes generously, to the writings of Peter Kreeft, William Buckley, Oliver Cromwell, Russell Kirk, Joseph Pieper, Pope Francis, G.K. Chesterton, John Henry Newman, Eric Gill, Richard Neuhaus, Anthony Esselin, Jacques Maritain, Mother Teresa, François-René de Chateaubriand, and Joseph de Maistre, who mocks enlightenment wrongheadedness with the rhetorical question, "Mad as we are, if we want a mirror to reflect the image of the sun, will we turn it towards the earth?" His answer is yes. The prose is lively, and there are surprises around every turn. We learn that nostalgia is built from the Greek for return home, and pain, as in homesickness, making it a relative of neuralgia and myalgia, that Scouting's father, Robert Baden-Powell, looked east to command the samurai spirit to British schoolboys, that socialism was big among Baptists and other evangelicals in Oklahoma in the early 1900s, that Margaret Thatcher represented the Wesleyan strand of Methodism rather than the primitive strand, that in the flux of modernist culture, churches should supply parishioners with the novelty of consistency, and he uses a special seasoning of cheekiness as when he observes that Prince, now King Charles, is the opposite of a politician. He has nothing to say, yet everyone, great and small, hangs on every empty word. There's similar effect when people are introduced to beautiful women and chimpanzees. Their exoticism casts an egalitarian spell. All eyes in the room are on them. And I've not seen such an endearing quotation as one by Stanley himself. I pray this book doesn't sell too well. His reason, every penny made from the sale of this book puts me one penny further from Christ, who, when asked by a rich man how to enter the kingdom of heaven, replied that he could begin by giving away everything he had. In sum, Stanley has penned a paean to tradition, one that celebrates the contribution of venerable culture. It is, on balance, a fine read, but in my estimation, he shortchanges two things. First, the exceptionalism of Judeo-Christian culture and the Protestant evangelical contribution to it. Second, the terrible aspects of tradition that make it at least as baleful as it is meritorious across the centuries. And to bolster the status of tradition, which he grants comes in morally various forms, with slavery is the basement, he's too quick to ignore, mitigate, or extenuate the persistently toxic versions or to rescue them by pointing to later pruned full-flowering examples. Tradition at its best, I'm reminded of Anthony Flew's no true Scotsman fallacy, as in no true Scotsman would put sugar in his porridge, so mutatis mutandis, no tradition worth its name would fail to evolve into something admirable. As he put it early on, this book is not a defense of snobbery, elitism, or pickling things in aspic, progress is integral to tradition, except when it isn't. Mark Coppinger.